Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 29th of February, as we record Leap Day. And we're going to jump right into today's show, which will start by looking at our cover feature this week. That's all about power brands and whether the big consumer goods companies are getting things right at a time when big price rises mean sales volumes are starting to come under pressure. That feeds into our results coverage this week because Haleon reported full year figures this morning and Reckitt Benckiser did so yesterday. We'll be examining the diverging fortunes of these consumer health companies later on. And finally, we will take a look at some of the M&A activity that's been springing up lately again in the UK market, or rather not in some cases, because management teams have been taking a sterner line on some of these offers. Joining me to discuss all of this in the studio, Jennifer Johnson.
Hi, Dan.
Hello. And over the line, Julian Hoffman.
Hello there. Good morning.
And I was about to say hello to Mark Robinson, but he's not here yet. He will be joining us later on, though. We're going to get cracking with the cover feature this week. On the shelves, by the time you hear this podcast, it's about power brands. Jen, you wrote this feature. Let's start by talking about the context. Why are consumer staples under pressure? Maybe it's quite an easy question to answer because they're under pressure because we're under pressure having to deal with these increasingly expensive goods that they sell us all.
Yes. So consumer staples, as you've alluded to, are under pressure because of what's known in industry jargon as down trading. Companies have passed cost increases onto consumers, and in certain categories for certain products, consumers respond by seeking out cheaper private label products. So these are the own brand goods that you see in supermarkets that contain the same key ingredients as branded products, but are often a fraction of the price. So that is the key issue that's facing your Reckitts and your Haleons at the moment.
Yeah, this is a concern from investors' point of view that has been lingering for a while, ever since inflation really took off. People thought, well, now is when the brand power of these companies will be tested. Will consumers buy a tub of Marmite when it costs £4 rather than £2? Will they look for an own brand equivalent? It's only really in the last few quarters or the last few quarters of updates from these companies that we have seen that pressure come through in some areas. I know private label manufacturers, for example, did have some problems scaling up their production to meet increased demand. Mm. But yes, we are in a situation now where inflation's been rising, food inflation is still in positive territory. These prices have been going up and up. Consumers are under pressure. We're reaching the limits in some cases. Therefore, this downtrading is happening. However, one thing the piece looks at is whether there are parts of the consumer goods world which might be more resilient than others.
Mm. So in particular, consumers seem less willing to trade down on over-the-counter medicines. And there are a couple of theories behind this. One, when you're ill or a family member is ill, you're likely to turn to a brand that you trust or that you perceive as reliable and high quality. Many of us already have this established relationship with products like Strepsils or Lemsip, both of which are manufactured by Reckitt. We might have been given these by our parents when we were younger and we associate them with feeling better. So this association persists into later life. The second reason medicines are more resilient is that ideally we aren't buying them very often. We might buy things like dishwasher tablets or baked beans on a fairly regular basis, and we're therefore more likely to notice the price increases on our preferred brands. Then we'll trade down once we deem them too expensive. If you have, say, a couple of colds a year, you're probably not going to approach, you know, the over-the-counter medicines aisle with an eye to saving 15p or 20p or whatever it might be. So it's a matter of kind of emotions as well as of price awareness.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Nurofen, to take an example, again, manufactured by Reckitt, is the kind of thing people will buy they won't buy something that's half the price with exactly the same ingredients, because that's, you know, the power of the brand, and you know, all that familiarity is in there. We should say, I suppose, it's not a done deal, though, for these companies just to manufacture consumer health products. And, you'll be away. Reckitt's results yesterday did show that their volumes are coming under pressure, which is, of course, what happens when price rises become too great for too many people, and revenue may still be rising, but because of these price rises, but volumes are falling at the same time, and that worries investors.
Mm.
Let's shift slightly, though, because one interesting aspect of the piece was when we looked at not so much a pain relief product, but we looked at toothpaste. Mm. We looked at Sensodyne in particular. Quite an interesting story there.
Yeah. As interesting as toothpaste can possibly
be. Well, yeah, it's all relative.
But the story of Sensodyne is that it's been around for well over a century. It was invented or kind of formulated by a pharmacist in New York in the early 1900s. He later founded his own company, which was ultimately acquired by one of the earlier incarnations of GSK around sort of the year 2000. And at the time, Sensodyne was this peripheral product that was only sold in certain pharmacies, despite the fact, obviously, that tooth sensitivity is this really common issue. So GSK obviously knew to some degree that they were kind of onto a winner with this product. Their initial strategy was to just stock it in supermarkets, so to stock it more widely, and consumers will become aware of it and think, oh gosh, I've had this problem for ages and look at this solution. But actually, just the stocking in a greater range of places had this limited effect. The marketing geniuses at GSK eventually realised that most people with this sort of tooth pain didn't really know what it was, or that it is a sign of a structural problem with their teeth. So tooth sensitivity happens when your enamel or your gums get worn down and this kind of lower layer of your tooth gets exposed to a stimulus like a cold drink. Sales only took off of Sensodyne once GSK started marketing the product as a cure for what they call dentine hypersensitivity. And they also made sure dentists were telling patients that this is a problem that can be solved with a toothpaste. So through marketing, they basically told people about this problem that existed. And, you know, before people might have just thought that, oh, you know, it's the cold drink that's causing this issue rather than the structural problem with the tooth. So they kind of created the problem, or created awareness of the problem, at the same time they were telling people that there's a solution. So this really is the kind of gold standard of, over-the-counter healthcare products.
Mm. Sensodyne is still doing very well, as we saw this morning in Haleon's results, which we'll come to in a moment. That particular brand well ahead of forecasts. But let's stay with the idea of consumer health in general. There are two things to pick up on here, or that I want to pick up on here. One is that there are more companies and more listed companies in this space, Haleon being one example. Is this getting more competitive from investors' point of view? Perhaps more opportunities, but equally, if you've got a lot of listed companies there, there's going to be pressure to innovate, which leads me to my second point, which is about innovation, if you can call it that, because of course you need new products in order to keep growing sales and to keep growing volumes. And in this kind of area, they are often iterative rather than something brand new, but that can work quite well in some cases.
Yeah, so on the competition point, in terms of the sheer number of players in consumer health, this is becoming a more crowded market. And that's because you've had pharmaceutical companies deciding to offload these kind of lower margin parts of their business. And that's because we've got these kind of patent cliffs. This is something that the pharmaceutical industry is really concerned about. So they need to invest in the development of new pharmaceutical drugs, you know, the ones that are prescribed by doctors, because their existing portfolios are only under patent protection for so long. Or the existing drugs in their portfolios are only under patent protection for so long. So they really kind of need cash. One way of generating this cash, obviously, is to offload your consumer health business. So that's what GSK did with Haleon. Last year, Johnson & Johnson offloaded its consumer health arm, which is now trading as Kenvue. In recent months, we've heard that Sanofi, that's the French pharmaceutical giant, is planning to do the same for its consumer business in the not-too-distant future. We don't know whether that will end up ultimately being a private company or whether it'll IPO. The shape of that is still kind of yet to be decided. But the thing to keep in mind with these new consumer health groups is that their products have been jostling for market share already. It isn't like there's going to be this huge new range of products that flood into established markets. Where there is more of a battle is in emerging markets. So these are places where consumers won't necessarily have these long-standing relationships with toothpaste or with painkiller brands. In developed markets, the threat isn't necessarily other consumer health companies at the moment, but it is these private label brands that we discussed earlier.
Mm. And I suppose more listed companies with a sole focus on this area might mean there may be the case when they're part of a bigger business, part of the pharma side of things, that not that aspect of the business, consumer health, was being left to lag, but now they are managed by a management team solely focused on the area. You can see more competition coming that way, perhaps. Mm. Now they're sole dedicated companies. But maybe that's a spitballing that has no basis in reality. I'm sure they were prioritised quite a lot when they were part of the main businesses too. We'll come back to innovation in a minute when we talk about Reckitt, perhaps, because there's some interesting points there. But one company we haven't mentioned so far is Unilever, which is a company that focuses or has started focusing on what it calls its power brands. Part of the reason it's doing that is because it has been seeing volume declines in some areas. It has therefore been struggling with its competitiveness. It publishes this figure, market share figure, and where it's taking market share, where it's losing it. That figure has not been great in recent quarters. Obviously, it has a new chief executive, a new management team that we've spoken about on the show before. At the same time, they're a business focused across the consumer goods piece, of course. You know, the classic products being Magnums, Cornettos, Marmite, Hellmann's mayonnaise, things like that.
Yep.
They, however, do have an interest in the well-being side of things, which is tangential to consumer health, but something they are seeing some strength in at the moment, albeit we can't necessarily say it's a like-for-like with consumer health categories.
Yeah, and I suppose the distinction to make here is the kind of amount of science or scientific claims that back up these products. With something like, you know, Lemsip, which is based on paracetamol, you can say confidently 100% of the time, this is going to address your fever and body aches when you have the flu. With Sensodyne, it's like, this is definitely going to help with your tooth sensitivity. Unilever clearly understands that there is some counter-cyclical value in this sort of science-backed consumer health, which it actually doesn't have a great deal of kind of exposure to. It did make something like three bids for Haleon after GSK announced it was going to offload the business.
Mm.
So, again, the more scientific side of things is clearly of interest. In the absence of a real kind of genuine consumer health portfolio, they've been kind of pushing this upstart health and wellness unit, which sells vitamins and electrolyte drinks, and in its kind of, it's also got a beauty arm where they're selling products that are kind of designed to look like something you might get from a dermatologist, skincare products that, you know, have scientific claims or ingredients that are proven to work. So it's trying to get in on this kind of loyalty, really, the loyalty that an effective product can have, really. When you look at something like Marmite or a vegetable stock cube, that is something that's very easily replaced. And an own brand vegetable stock cube is going to be just as effective in flavouring your food as Unilever's. So it's trying to get in on some of this, this scientifically proven stuff, even if it's not strictly selling medicines. And it's you know, the success or failure of these products really is not down to whether they work or not, but it's down to how effective the marketing is.
Yeah, whether they can become a power brand doesn't necessarily need a basis in scientific reality.
Indeed.
Unilever is an interesting company. It's in the middle of this attempt to turn around. And yesterday, Terry Smith at the Fundsmith AGM, I believe, made some more conciliatory noises. He is has been a disgruntled shareholder in the business. Nelson Peltz, another investor, is now on the board. So they have got some of these investors on the right side, but there doesn't seem to be much sign yet of a turnaround at an operational level. So we'll see in the next few quarters how well that is going. Let's look at Haleon more closely now, though, because their figures were out this morning, as mentioned. And we can contrast them with Reckitt, because Reckitt yesterday had a rather disappointing set of figures, whereas this morning Haleon's figures look overall pretty good.
Yeah, I think as good as you can expect them to look, given that, you know, even if they do have these power brands in the portfolio, there is still going to be a degree of downtrading in the macro environment. That's really inevitable. But again, the power brands were its sales standouts. 6 out of 9 of them delivered double-digit revenue growth. Interestingly, emerging markets, which account for about a third of turnover, saw revenue expand by almost 15% across the 2023 financial year. There was less momentum in developed economies, where sales ticked up by just under 5%. There were some issues with margins when you look at the whole year. Gross margin fell by 90 basis points to just under 60% due to obviously the well-documented impacts of cost inflation that have been hitting consumer companies more generally. But we did see these headwinds start to ease towards the end of the year, resulting in gross margin growth in the fourth quarter. So the company has been impacted in a way that you would completely predict and isn't at all surprising. But things are looking up. I think there's some reason for quiet optimism.
Yes, that seems to be a good summation. There were some FX charges in there, which complicated things as well. One thing we should speak about is the buyback. Clearly, Haleon is far from alone in announcing a buyback in recent months, but it could be particularly useful for them because one of the concerns people have about the company is the overhang of shareholdings owned still by GSK and Pfizer. Now, there have been some sell downs over the past year, I believe, but they still own a good chunk of the company, about a third, I think.
Just over, yeah.
So the buyback could work quite well. Haleon said this morning on the analyst call that they could do the buyback in the open market, or preferably they could wait for another stake sale by GSK or Pfizer and do the buyback then, which would turn a negative into a positive. Clearly, they can't tell when GSK or Pfizer will start selling their next tranche of shares, but that does at least provide perhaps some solace for investors who are still worried about this overhang and this share sale that will have to happen at some point.
Yeah, I guess the thing that investors are concerned about here is that GSK or Pfizer are just going to flood the market with these shares, which would send the share price down. So the buyback is clearly designed to reassure these investors, as we don't really have any insight into what Pfizer or GSK are going to do and when. The only other thing not to be concerned about, I would say, but to be aware of, is that it is upping its dividend and announcing the share buyback at a time where it's still fairly indebted. Its net debt to adjusted EBITDA figure currently sits at 3x, which some analysts have said might be a little bit of a sticking point for some investors. Management pointed out in the results that in the last 18 months since the demerger, it reduced its net debt by over £2 billion. It brought that net debt to adjusted EBITDA figure down from 4x to 3x. So clearly it's also, while it's aware that the buyback is kind of necessary, it's also aware that it doesn't look great. The optics aren't great with this level of leverage. So that's something to keep in mind. But I think when you look at Halion, the problems that Halion is facing compared to the problems that Reckitt is facing, if it's an either or choice in consumer health, Halion is definitely in the better position at the moment.
They have been selling brands themselves as well, which gives them some wiggle room on the cash and the leverage front. Chapstick, mm-hmm. which is apparently a lip balm brand, was the latest sale for $430 million last month. So they do have some wiggle room there, as I say. This is a good time to turn to Reckitt, because Reckitt's results yesterday, part of the reason they were disappointing was the cold and flu season, which, despite all the attributes of consumer health companies we've spoken about, there are things they can't control, like the timing of cold and flu season.
Yeah.
This year, it was quite late, and therefore, at Reckitt at least, sales volumes took an even bigger fall as a result of that. They sold less of those products in those areas. Halion, by comparison, that segment held up quite well, which I think they put down to being in different geographic areas from competitors.
Mm.
But let's turn to Reckitt, because we look at Reckitt in the cover feature as well, and some of the issues with that business. And there's a question of over-innovation, perhaps, when it comes to Reckitt.
Yeah, it is. And I think that part of the reason, we should say, first of all, that the results yesterday looked disappointing. Volumes were down by more than 4% for the full year. All three divisions, health, hygiene and nutrition, went backwards on units sold. But there are, if we're being generous, some kind of one-off factors here. One of them is that nutrition volumes fell by 10% because the company had benefited from supply shortages in infant formula, in the infant formula market last year.
Mm.
So their competitor in this area, Abbott Labs, had some supply issues. So it's not an easy like-for-like comparison. And as you said, with the cold and flu season thing, it's also not that easy because obviously we had a pandemic when cold and flu products would have been in high demand. Then after the pandemic, there was some evidence that everyone was just kind of getting ill more generally once we started mixing again. So that was going to be good for Reckitt sales. Likewise with hygiene, you know, it's going to be tough to compare performance with the past couple of years because everyone was going to be using, large quantities of things like Dettol disinfectant when we were in that pandemic and just sort of post-lockdown period. So some of these things are one-offs. Some analysts have also argued that management is setting itself up for failure with high revenue targets, and also that the company has kind of put out iterations of certain products that don't represent a significant improvement on past products. So you're just kind of adding an ingredient or marketing something slightly differently. So they've sort of arguably wasted money there. But I think the reality is, and something to keep in mind for investors, is that consumer businesses aren't going to deliver growth in the way that tech companies are at any point. So it's a matter of managing expectations, understanding that we're coming out of this highly irregular period for things like health and hygiene. So yeah, while there are reasons to be concerned about Reckitt, there's also this accounting issue in the Middle East, which kind of scared investors off yesterday, but is a separate issue to what we've been discussing. I think Reckitt's kind of a wait and see.
Mm. Yes, some of these products as well, there's a fine line sometimes between a unnecessary and failed innovation and one that ends up selling lots, isn't
yeah.
there? When you think of all different, to go back to traditional consumer goods, all different flavours of things that some of them take off, some of them crash and burn. I can't think of any specific examples, but who knows? What do I stick to? Sour cream and onion Pringles. don't really deviate from the one flavour, but there we go. Julian, you've been sitting patiently through all this. What are your thoughts on Reckitt as a company at the moment?
It's an interesting dilemma for investors. The first point to make, and it's probably a general one really to what we call defensive shares, is that investors traditionally are terrible at valuing the company. So the slightest either under or over performance, the market tends to overreact. So I don't envy Reckitt's management really in trying to deal with the market at the moment. I would class them more as a momentum share really rather than defensive. But yes, there is a there is a phenomenon really where this situation that they're facing, the scenario, is inevitable because they can only defy consumer spending for so long before they give back all the gains they've made. And I don't see the company as badly run or anything, but it's definitely a much more volatile share than people give it credit for, I think. And the results really were just the trigger for essentially a momentum change. It is a case that they'll probably find their feet. It's definitely a well-run and well-organized business. So you think that this is just par for the course as far as I can see.
Yeah, well, Reckitt too have a relatively new management team in place, or certainly new chief executive. So we can maybe expect some shake-up there. And you did see some of that yesterday with, I think, some of the suggestions of what they're going to do. They've already said they're going to invest more in R&D, which, again, can be a double-edged sword. This is one area where investors do like to see R&D, but equally, it's got to be in the right places, and working out what those places are is easier said than done.
It's also not particularly efficient. I mean, it's all very well, shouting at them that they've got to spend money on research and development, but it's how that actually translates into new products, which is the key problem to overcome. Mm. So they'll come up with, I'm sure they'll come up with some new ideas, but it's, in the meantime, you just have to stick with it as a far more volatile share than anyone actually perceives it to be. But, that's just the reality of the market, really.
Mm. Well, the thing about these companies, all of them, however much the individual products are in vogue, all of them we've spoken about so far today, they are big cash generators, aren't they? They are throwing off a lot of cash at all times, and therefore the total return to shareholders can be pretty reliable. But I'm sure this topic will run and run. It's run its course for now, though. We are going to turn to our final section of the show, which is about M&A activity in the UK market. And we'll start with a couple of recent approaches that have been rejected by management, because to me that's quite interesting. Last year, or the year before, certainly you saw a lot of M&A in the UK, a lot of deals being done at levels that some shareholders complained about. You didn't see too many rejections by management. However, in the past few days, we've seen Currys, and we've also seen a Direct Line push back on opening offers. I dare say there may be more to come. Julian, why don't we start with you and Direct Line, because you cover them. What did you make of this approach yesterday by a Belgian rival?
It definitely opportunistic, I would say, on their part, because Direct Line, as we know from our coverage, has been underperforming really for the last 2 years at least, arguably longer. So the shares have struggled to get back towards their listing price now five years ago now, when RBS got rid of it. I would say that management can afford to hold out on this one, if only because the new guy is going to start tomorrow. So they've appointed a new chief executive who ran successfully a division of Aviva's motor assurance division. It's really a question. They probably fixed the balance sheet. It's just, have they now? They now need to go into the weeds of their operations in order to improve their performance. So, I would say that if they sold out now, they would probably be undervaluing the company quite significantly, because that process of sorting out where it had gone wrong in terms of its underwriting is kind of now starting, and that will inevitably sort of deliver a structural uplift, because it will be working a lot better by this time next year. So I wasn't surprised that was rejected, and probably the shareholders are going to get a better deal in the long run if they stick with the new management team rather than suddenly just change over to becoming a kind of Belgian subsidiary, as it were.
Mm. Well, we'll see if they do come back with another bid. That is a very good point about the new CEO starting tomorrow. This bid, I should say, came to light yesterday, but it was made at the end of January, nonetheless, very recent. And we have seen some takeovers in the UK insurance space in recent years. And there's no doubt after the last couple of years that Direct Line, with all its profit warnings, of which there have been multiple, is quite lowly valued. Mark, I believe you are now with us. Welcome. I want to ask you about the other rejected bid from recent weeks, which is Currys. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that one in particular.
I don't have that many specific thoughts related to Currys itself. I mean, obviously, in common with a lot of high street businesses, it's been struggling with falling sales as customers have cut back on spending. I mean, that's a fairly straightforward argument. But like Julian mentioned before, I mean, there's always going to be an opportunistic sort of element to this, given UK ratings relative to their overseas counterparts at the moment. I think the interesting thing as we move into this year, and it's something that I pointed out recently in one of my columns, will be the increased influence of arbitrage or merger arbitrage opportunities. A few weeks ago, I pointed out the situation with smart metering systems and their prospective takeover from KKR. Now, certainly the influence of private equity has been commented upon in the past, and smart metering system fits in with KKR's determination to increase their exposure to the general energy transition, and that business is a lower risk option on that front. But I think we're going to start seeing a lot of specialist arbitrage funds coming into the market as well. And this presents some opportunities for retail investors, or at least those with understanding of this process and those willing to take on a bit of risk. It's a situation whereby investors will have to look at certain risk factors, the offer price itself, the spread, together with any regulatory issues and the possibility that the bid would be rejected by either the target or acquiring company's shareholders. The logic behind this, of course, is when a bid is made, there's normally a shortfall in terms of the target company's share price and the offer price, and that spread there is where the opportunity lies, and that's why people, institutions that engage in this for a living, they'll be looking at that. And of course, with you're going to see more entrants in the market as well, given the fact that most people expect UK equity prices to rise as the year progresses. Once we get some crystallised idea of when the rate cutting process will start, those valuations would creep up. I mean, that's the orthodox view of it anyway. So it's quite interesting. I think we've mentioned in one of the podcasts in the past that we expected M&A volumes to increase this year. In this early part as well, we're probably going to see a little bit more rejections because of the opportunistic nature of some of those bids. So I don't think there's anything more than that, really.
Mm. To return to Currys, the aspect of this which may be indicative as well is the fact that there is a potential bidding war there. Elliott has made a couple of rejected bids. JD.com of China is supposedly interested too. And that has echoes in other companies as well. Just today, Wincanton, which was already being bid for by a French company, we've seen GXO Logistics come in with a much higher bid. So from shareholders' point of view, that is a pretty attractive prospect, whether or not they get involved in the merger arbitrage strategies, because they can simply sit back and watch as these higher bids come in. But maybe that's a very rose-tinted view of the market at the moment. There is no doubt, Mark, as you say, that we are due an uptick, I think, given valuations being where they are, and given last year, I think the fall was about 20% in terms of M&A activity in the UK market. Perhaps I mentioned Elliott there, but apart from that, all these bids we've spoken about have been overseas companies as well, rather than private equity. Private equity has its own problems. So perhaps that's a sign of things to come too, that these are actually going to be other companies looking at these businesses and looking for combinations there rather than a PE type buyouts, of which we saw quite a lot in 2022.
Yeah, and obviously, the underlying reason for all this is that the cost of financing these type of deals is going to fall throughout the year too. We could say it's just a natural consequence of what's going to happen because of the cost of capital will come down over time. So we shouldn't be too surprised. I would just reiterate that point to our listeners out there. It is worthwhile just having a look at some arbitrage strategies because if nothing else, they're quite good fun.
Well, that's what we're all here for at the end of the day, isn't it? I mean, you could say our listeners are here to make money as well, but why not both? On which note, we have sadly come to the end of today's show. So thank you very much to Mark, to Julian, to Jen, and to our producer, Maddie Atthorpe. We will be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.